Our first case for argument this morning is Prate Installations against the Regional Council of Carpenters.
Good morning.
Mr. Ketterman.
Good morning, and may it please the court. My name is Travis Ketterman, and I represent the Chicago Regional Council of Carpenters. Your Honors, there are three reasons to vacate this arbitration award in its entirety. First, as the district court held, the arbitrator, who was selected under the 2001 agreement, improperly exceeded the scope of his authority by exercising authority and jurisdiction under the 2005 and 2008 agreements. Without a doubt, this arbitrator was selected under that 2001 agreement. The 2001 agreement expired on September 30, 2005, and on October 1, 2005, the union and RCEC had negotiated a successor agreement, which instituted a standing panel of five arbitrators who would rotate contract disputes. It is undisputed that arbitrator James Martin was not a member of that standing panel and thus had no authority to determine whether the contract was violated after October 1, 2005. The second point, once the arbitrator had found that the union did not negotiate another collective bargaining agreement with Prate's competitors, his finding that the union had still violated the most favored nations fails to draw its essence from the contract. Instead, the arbitrator based his violation on an impermissible thought or feeling, namely that the union had targeted Prate and that the union was out to destroy Prate. But that union's conduct, the so-called selective enforcement theory, is not sufficient. It is outside the contract, and therefore the violation does not draw its essence from the contract. We understand the daunting challenge of overturning a labor arbitration award. We are not, indeed cannot, argue that the arbitrator merely misinterpreted the contract. But the question is, to what ruling do you defer? We submit that when the arbitrator made the factual and legal finding that the union did not negotiate another collective bargaining agreement with Prate's competitors, that any award beyond that does not draw its essence from the contract. What you should defer to...
Excuse me, I'm not sure I understand your argument. Are you saying that the union had no collective bargaining agreements with Prate's competitors?
We had the 2001 RCEC agreement. As the arbitrator found, that was the only agreement. The 2001 RCEC agreement was the agreement under which Prate worked. It was the agreement under which Prate's competitors worked. So, Your Honor, it's clear the union negotiates a master collective bargaining agreement with the multi-employer association.
Yes.
Prate's owner was a director of this multi-employer association. There is one...
I just want to be sure. There is, in fact, a collective bargaining agreement with Prate and between the union and its competitors.
Yes.
The difficulty I have with your argument in this respect is that it's well understood in federal labor practice that collective bargaining agreements can be amended by course of practice. So if I understand Prate's claim collectively correctly, it's that the union amended this master agreement by course of practice with other employers and refused to do that with Prate. Now, that's a perfectly normal contract argument. Why is it outside the arbitrator's jurisdiction to consider?
Because that's not what the arbitrator found. If the arbitrator...
What language of the contract are you relying on?
The most favored nations is in 21.1 of the agreement.
Yeah, I know that, but what's that say specifically?
That says that it requires that the... union, there must be more favorable terms agreed to by the union in any collective bargaining agreement with another construction employer. We submit, when you look at the purpose of a most favored nations, in the absence of a most favored nations, nobody's going to negotiate the first contract. The employer will always fear that if they negotiate a contract with the union on Monday, that on Tuesday, the union will go out and negotiate a better deal with its competitor.
Your argument is that requires an explicit agreement with the other employer.
Yes, And the arbitrator could have found that through conduct, the union entered into another collective bargaining agreement. But that is not what this arbitrator found. This arbitrator found, to quote him, the evidence does not support Prate's claims that other contracts were negotiated between the unions and Prate's competitors.
You're saying that's everyone should have been like the overhead door contract that they had earlier if they were going to do anything different?
Prate wanted a piece rate.
The overhead door contract was that, wasn't it?
The overhead door was an addendum covering the garage doors that did contain some type of piece rate or productivity standard. What Prate wanted in the 98 negotiations was that type of productivity payment to be applied to residential roofing.
But you're saying that in order for there to be, I guess, an amendment, they had to have it in writing as they did with overhead door.
Our argument before the arbitrator was that it needed to be in writing. I agree with Judge Easterbrook's assumptions or statements that a contract can be amended by conduct. But the arbitrator did not find that here. The arbitrator did not find that there was another collective bargaining agreement through the conduct of the union and the employer. The arbitrator specific.
I don't think you're understanding. One doesn't need to find a separate piece of paper. An agreement already negotiated can be amended by course of conduct. Right? When the arbitrator said the union didn't negotiate a separate collective bargaining agreement, he means no separate piece of paper. But amending the existing agreement by conduct is, one might think, something that a reasonable arbitrator could find to be within the scope of the Most Favored Nations Clause.
Your Honor, I would submit it.
Just don't understand why not.
I submit it's similar to the Anheuser-Busch case, in which case the arbitrator had found that...
It doesn't look like either side realizes, since both sides cite from Anheuser-Busch. Anheuser-Busch has no precedential value, we said in Findorff, because there was no opinion for the court. Right? The argument that you quote from Anheuser-Busch is the language you quote from Anheuser-Busch, we held in Findorff, was not right, and was not the law of this circuit. So why you want to quote language that's already been identified as not the law of the Seventh Circuit is quite beyond me.
I think that the facts were similar. But in any event, what we have here is the arbitrator basing it on conduct that is outside the contract. The arbitrator did not find that there was an amendment to the contract. The arbitrator found selective enforcement. Take this by way of analogy. If Prate was saying, rather than a different wage rate, if Prate was saying that his competitors failed to pay their taxes properly and that the IRS had not enforced the Internal Revenue Code on all of his competitors, that lack of enforcement, that selective enforcement theory, isn't going to overturn or amend the Internal Revenue Code. A selective enforcement...
Well, it may not amend the Internal Revenue Code, but it can certainly amend the labor contract.
Yeah. Look, the Department of the Treasury cannot amend a statute, but a union and an employer can amend a collective bargaining agreement by course of conduct. You disagree with that proposition?
No.
Okay.
But I do not agree that that's what the arbitrator found. The arbitrator did not find that through the course of conduct there was another collective bargaining agreement with the union and the employer. There is only one contract here. The arbitrator did not find that contract to be amended.
Well, it's just not enforcing it against anyone else. At least it wasn't apparent.
But that is not the same as
saying... Well, what is the proper claim then? What is an employee or, an employer who is a member, a party to the contract, what does he do when he thinks they're picking on him and leaving everyone else alone, leaving all his competitors alone to allow to submit piecework as part of their bid, when he's not allowed to? If he was afraid to do it because they knew they'd come down on him in a hurry, as they did in the past. What's he to do?
Then that becomes the proper subject of collective bargaining negotiations.
Back to the bargaining table then.
Back to the bargaining table.
In the middle of the contract.
Exactly. And again, it's important to remember that Prate's bargaining representatives, the multi-employer association of which he was a member, which he was a director, never instituted a piece rate provision in the RCEC agreements. Not in 98, not in 2001, not in 2005, not in 2008. There is, at any given time, only one contract. That contract has not been amended by conduct. That's not the finding of the arbitrator. If there's only this one contract, there cannot be a violation of the most favored nations claim.
But he found many of the others who were parties to the contract, many other employers, were using piecework.
But those would be contract violations. That is not a contract amendment. Just because one or more of competitors violate the contract, contract violations don't equal contract amendments.
It would be a different case. Look, maybe this all boils down to understanding what the arbitrator did, but I don't understand the arbitrator to say the other employers were violating the contract. The arbitrator found that this was done with the union's consent, right? So it's as if the clause is amended to say that Prate has to pay on an hourly rate, employers B, C, and D can pay on some different basis, and goodness only knows about the rest. If all we had was a finding that other employers had violated the contract and the union was screaming bloody murder, you would have a much stronger position. But that's certainly not what the arbitrator said. Is it? What am I missing in the arbitrator's decision?
I think what's important is that there was no other understanding by the arbitrator.
Did the arbitrator find that the union was protesting and attempting to get these other employers to pay hourly rates?
This arbitrator found that the union did not enforce the piece rate provision.
Yeah.
Well. The arbitrator did not make that then a contract by conduct. This would be an entirely different case if the arbitrator says, I find that through this conduct there is another collective bargaining agreement out there.
Well, if you don't enforce something, you consent to it, don't you?
But there is not the finding of another collective bargaining agreement. There may be a finding by the arbitrator. And again, obviously the union cannot at this point contest those factual findings. We vigorously disputed that at the arbitration hearing. But the point is there is no other collective bargaining agreement. Your Honor, I'd submit it's similar to the Amex Coal case.
From failure to enforce.
Well, I would submit it that it's failure to the Amex, similar to the Amex Coal case in the Seventh Circuit in 1996. And that time, the company found that the arbitrator found the company did not violate the agreement by changing these positions from oiler to welders, but nevertheless must offer training and higher pay. The Seventh Circuit found that that ultimate decision is inconsistent. I submit here, too, when the arbitrator found that there was no other agreement negotiated by the union, that his finding of a most fair violation was inconsistent. I also think it's important to note that much of the conduct relied upon by Prate and cited to in the arbitration decision was pre-July 2002. That conduct is covered by a release, a full release that Prate Installations gave the Carpenters. And just because it is, the arbitration's decision, when read in its entirety, shows that this arbitrator was animated and motivated by that conduct. Just because the arbitrator said it isn't so, as the Supreme Court and the Seventh Circuit have constantly said, you cannot make the noise of contract interpretation.
Were the contractors, I should say the Carpenters, who testified referring to something before 2002 when they said they were being paid piecework?
Some of that testimony, yes. But
it seemed to me this thing dragged on quite a while. You think those people came in? I didn't get that from reading that, but maybe you're saying that's the case.
Well, what's important that I think motivated the arbitrator, and this is an impermissible thought and feeling outside the contract, was Prate's testimony and Prate's allegations and what Prate found in the and what the arbitrator found in the agreement was conduct during the 98 negotiations and conduct during the 2002 strike of the union. The arbitrator found that President Oliver was out to destroy the Prate. That is all pre-July 2002 conduct.
Now I'm thoroughly puzzled. Because you protested strongly in the district court and won to the extent the arbitrator's order extends past 2005.
Correct.
But if the conduct in question is not extending past 2005, how did that aspect of the order aggrieve you? Indeed, if it's not extending past 2002, how were you aggrieved by that portion of the arbitrator's order?
Because it was that conduct that I submit was the impermissible thought or feeling which...
Answer my question. My question is, how are you aggrieved by an order extending past 2005 if the conduct in question ended in or before 2002?
We were aggrieved by the money damage award that accounted for the period after October 1st, 2005, and by the arbitration.
There can be a money award only if the conduct continued past 2005. The argument you began to make is all of this was over in 2002. But the fact that there's a money award for post-2002 conduct shows it's not over.
No, my argument was not that it was over by 2002. My argument is that much of the conduct which animated the union, the arbitrator's award, occurred pre-2002.
Those carpenters who testified, who he determined were credible, the ones that went in against their interest, said that they were being paid piecework. You're saying that was all before 2002?
No, not at all. Some of that.
Well,
some,
then, okay. But that now, if it's current regarding the 2002.
Let me make two points on that. The only pre-2002 conduct I was referring to that I think motivated the arbitrator was the 98 negotiations and the 2002 strike.
You referred to that as background. You
correct.
Said it didn't.
Exactly. And what I'm saying is that would be impermissible because of the release to use that as a basis for this award. Let me make a note on the conduct after October 1st, 2005. Remember what, in essence, Prate is alleging. Prate is alleging that his competitors were given more favorable terms or that the union failed to enforce the contract. After October 1st, 2005, the contract that Prate was working under, the contract that Prate said was not being enforced, was the 2005 agreement. And it's that 2005 agreement that this arbitrator could not exercise authority over. That's the finding of the district court. So I want to be clear on what our argument is. I see I'm in rebuttal. Thank you.
Well, before you sit down, I would like you to address one issue I didn't understand in the briefs, and that has to do with attorney's fees. Did arbitrator Martin order you to pay any particular amount of attorney's fees?
No. The
district court said that arbitrator Martin also did not retain jurisdiction, right?
Correct.
So is there any attorney's fees issue in this case? If the arbitrator didn't order you to pay some sum of money as attorney's fees, what's the beef?
It is our beef that there is no attorney fee award because the arbitrator did not order that. There was not a sum specific ordered.
Right.
He did not
I could understand. I could understand the Prate complaining about it, but in your brief, you're the one who complains about it. But it looks to me like you're the winner. Right? There was a dispute about attorney's fees, and arbitrator Martin didn't order you to pay a cent. There's language in his opinion that's different from that, but he didn't order you to pay anything.
I agree, Your Honor.
So why are you complaining? Why is Prate not complaining? I'm just totally lost.
Well, we thought on that issue he had no authority to even make that, but you're right, there is no order, and that's why we have not pushed it at oral argument.
Okay.
And it was
Thank
a pass.
You. Mr. Hollop.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the Court. My name is Josh Holub. I represent Prate Installations. Prate, as you know, is a small family-owned roofing company that's been in business for more than 30 years. It's our opinion that arbitrator Martin did what he was authorized to do. He interpreted the collective bargaining agreement, and he reached the correct decision. Where he reached a decision based on his interpretation of the collective bargaining agreement that the union violated the most favored nations provision in its fairly long course of conduct by allowing, in effect, modifying its collective bargaining agreement with Prate and modifying it with other employers and allowing them more favorable terms. The union tends to look at this as and cites the arbitrator's award and says, the arbitrator found that there is no other contract. Well, they took that quote out of context. The arbitrator, you know, if you look to the, I think, two sentences further in there, he says, but that is not necessary for me to reach this conclusion. And he comes forward with several different reasons as to how he interpreted the contract. And under the very broad standards for affirming, or you know, the limited standards for review of an arbitration award, which does not bear repeating here because it's so well established, he did what he was supposed to do. He interpreted the agreement. He analyzed thoroughly the language of the contract terms. He analyzed the purpose and the meaning and intent of that most favored nations provision, and he gave us three reasons why he believed it applied to this case, and therefore he's done what he was charged to do. Now, this issue that the union raises about selective enforcement is really a code word or a euphemism for some agreed change. I mean, the arbitrator found that there's a contract between the parties that provides for a level playing field for wages and other terms and conditions of employment, and he found that the union had, in a relatively wholesale fashion, modified the contract to the extent that it allowed other contractors the opportunity to pay on a more favorable pay system.
He refers to the company established this by proving that the union had agreements most likely unwritten with at least several other employers. Is that what you're referring to?
Right, and that's what that's what Judge Easterbrook was referring to in collective bargaining. A collective bargaining agreement is a living, breathing mechanism, and it can be amended by the conduct of the parties. And here, that's what occurred. And
a living, breathing mechanism? I suppose it follows that in Chicago it can even vote.
In any event, as is well established and as Judge Easterbrook has said, a collective bargaining agreement can be amended by the conduct of the parties. It could be amended implicitly. It could be amended expressly. Here, what was going on is that what the arbitrator found is that the union amended the contract. What the arbitrator had in front of him was evidence from a multi-year period of time, 4, 5, 6 years period of time, where Mr. Prate was going out into the field, and he would find that other contractors that had contracts, same contract with him, with the union, were paying people, its union employees, on a piecework basis rather than the hourly provisions of the contract. And then Mr. Prate did what a lot of employers don't do and what lawyers always counsel their clients to do is document, 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 and he would send letters and correspondence, and I think, you know, more than 75 of these letters were put into evidence at the hearing, and he would document at every location where he found people, the other contractors, paying on a piecework basis.
Are those generally bids that he lost?
Yeah, for the most part, yes. I mean, that's why he was out looking. And he was doing the job of the union organizer. He was doing the contract enforcement because what he was finding was that the union, on a regular basis, was allowing other companies to pay on a piecework basis. And it's not a matter of just inability to enforce the contract. What we have here is union was put on notice time and time again with very specific detail and locations, as the arbitrator found, and he drew the picture for them, and the union did nothing. What conclusion can you lead? I mean, you know, what conclusion is drawn from that? It's not just a mere inability to enforce. It's implicitly the union has modified the contract with regard to these other employers.
What about the 2005 agreement?
And with respect to the vacation, you know, our appeal, our position is this, and I think that the arbitrator's award should have been sustained. I think that the court below erred, and the reason for that is that the arbitrator has very broad powers under the collective bargaining agreement. And in this agreement, it says Article 18 of the collective bargaining agreement that was in effect when the grievance was filed, which was the 1998 to 2005 agreement. And it says that the arbitrator has jurisdiction over all questions involving the interpretation and application of any section of the agreement. And this case started in 2003 when the grievance was filed, and then an arbitrator was picked, and then the hearing in this case started in 2007, I believe, after that contract had expired. And but the union's conduct had continued from the beginning of the time that it launched this plan, the beginning of the time that it was extending more favorable benefits to the other employers. So it was just the conduct of the union continued, and the arbitrator was exercising his very broad remedial authority to come up with a...
You're advocating the continuing violation theory, then?
Yes, and that's a very kind of a broad term that's used in a variety of scenarios in the law. But what we have here is the arbitrator, the substantive provision of the 2005 contract, the most favored nation contract, remained the same. Most favored nation provision remained the same. The only difference was, as counsel has cited, is that the arbitration provision had changed. And so what we have here is, if, I mean, the arbitrator has broad authority to remedy a wrong. He heard the evidence of the wrong, and he came up with this, that it continued throughout this period of time, and that in order to make the company whole, he had to give them an award for that period of time. Otherwise, to follow, as the union would say, the mere expiration of the contract, if that cut off the period for which he could remedy the violation.
Don't you think it's significant here there was a new contract with new arbitrators?
Well, I don't believe that that's significant, because the arbitrator had been mutually selected by the parties in the first place. The violation continued under the first started under the first contract, continued even while the hearing, as the proceedings were going, the violation continued. Had Prate done what the union suggested, would file a second grievance, go to select an arbitrator under the new panel of arbitrators in the new collective, the 2005 collective bargaining agreement, you would have had duplicative litigation, parallel litigation going here, based upon the same exact facts. The facts here...
So?
Well, it seems to be that would be...
That looks like what was bargained for in the 2005 collective bargaining agreement, which set up a distinct method for obtaining judicial resolution.
Well, no.
Imagine the 2001 contract between parties says, this will be litigated exclusively in the Northern District of Illinois. And then they sign another contract in 2005 with a forum selection clause that says this will be litigated exclusively in the Northern District of Indiana. Surely you wouldn't think that the Northern District of Illinois could issue a decision covering a claim of violation of the later contract. There's a forum selection clause in it. Why isn't that equally true here?
Well, because this proceeding had started. And second,
well,
there's nothing in that contract.
Think about my hypothetical. The breach of contract suit in Northern Illinois had started on the 2001 contract. And then in 2005, they negotiate a new contract which says, we will agree to resolve our disputes in Northern Indiana. Right? Could the Northern District of Illinois say, well, this suit started first, so I'll just resolve their dispute about the 2005 contract, too? Would look to be a clear violation of the forum selection clause. And all arbitration is a form of forum selection clause. It says the parties have agreed on who and when will resolve their dispute.
But I would submit that this arbitration proceeding had started, and the arbitrator had reached his conclusions, and he was only making a remedy, which went forward into the next contract. And that...
Well, it didn't even start, you said, until 2007?
2007.
So the other one is already 2 years underway, isn't it? The other contract, by the time this hearing
Correct.
On this one started. Is there something to stop you from, if you didn't win this, to file a claim at this juncture under the 2005?
That may be a possibility. What happened procedurally in the arbitration was, the union, prior to the hearing, made a motion for summary judgment, arguing, among other things, that the arbitrator didn't have the authority to adjudicate conduct occurring after October 1st, 2005. And the arbitrator, after being fully briefed on the matter, He ruled that it was a continuing violation, that he had jurisdiction, and he denied the motion for summary judgment on that basis and the other bases.
Do you think the distinction can be made between, we'll call it the equitable part of his ruling, that the union could, or that the parade could continue until the union started enforcing this provision, that in the future, that's not a money award, as opposed to the money award, the damages for violation after 2005?
Well, I think that because the arbitrator has broad authority to fashion a remedy. And in other cases, in cases we cited, such as, I mean, Enterprise Wheel, as well as the Van Waters.
Of course, in Enterprise Wheel, there wasn't any subsequent contract with a different arbitrator, was there?
No. That's a unique circumstance to this case. But I would submit it, the issue is to focus on the arbitrator who's started hearing the case, and that he's making a remedy that goes forward into the, that covers a period into the contract that supersedes the original contract.
No, but have you got a better or worse case for the equitable remedy as opposed to the award of damages?
I think that Van Waters case that we cited from the Ninth Circuit says there was an order of liquidated damages that covered a time period into the future, and it seems like that's the closest analogy we've been able to find. And certainly, this is an unusual case. You know, you don't see many cases in labor arbitration where there's a grievance brought by an employer, particularly on an issue similar to this. The arbitrator was confronted with a fairly novel issue, and we think that he exercised the authority and interpreted the agreement, and therefore his award should be affirmed. With regard to the attorney's fee issue, the arbitrator, as you've noted, held that Prate should be reimbursed for the reasonable attorney's fees expended in prosecution of the grievance.
Did he say up to an amount?
He said up to, not to exceed $2 million. And the arbitrator, as the court observed, did not retain jurisdiction over this, and because...
So what's before us?
The union says he was not empowered to make that award.
No, but there wasn't any award.
Well, there's not an award of a dollar amount, but...
So if you say to the union, pay us X, the union says, nada, right?
Well, then I would assume we could file...
No, you can't go back to arbitrator Martin.
Not him, but we could file an arbitration.
You could file a separate arbitration, and a new arbitrator might or might not make an award.
No, but the...
But I don't understand. It seems to me it would just be an advisory opinion for a federal court to issue a declaration that an award, which is incomplete because it doesn't specify relief, right on the merits, but we don't get to relief because it's incomplete. That certainly sounds advisory to me.
Well, I think it's not advisory. It's he has found that in order to make Prate whole, that it's necessary to award him the attorney's fees and costs that he expended.
Well, let me change this. Suppose a district court says, I order Party A to pay Party B reasonable attorney's fees, and Party A then files a notice of appeal. Would we have jurisdiction? The answer is no. That's very well settled. There's just nothing there until the award has been quantified. Nothing reviewable. It's not final. The case ain't over.
Well, I think in this case, the arbitrator ruled that Prate is entitled to his attorney's fees, and I think that, I mean, in many cases, there can be, the parties end up working out an agreement as to what the reasonable attorney's...
If they work out an agreement, there's nothing to litigate. If they don't work out an agreement, they need an arbitrator's decision. Now, if you look at the Arbitration Act, an arbitrator's failure to finish the job, that is, failure to make a complete order, is a ground for vacating the order. It isn't a ground for enforcing the order in part.
Well, in this case, I would submit that the arbitrators that made a complete order as to the award of attorney's fees. That in effect, an arbitrator's award in a collective bargaining agreement dispute, you know, has the becomes a part of the collective bargaining agreement. So we have this award. We can now, if the union doesn't come to an agreement with us on the amount of the attorney's fees, we go back and file a grievance against the arbitrator. I mean, a grievance against the union, in asking for that another arbitrator to decide how much, not whether or not attorney's fees are merited, because they were awarded by the arbitrator.
Of course, implicitly it covers both before and after the 2005, doesn't it? The attorney's fees.
It would.
Yeah.
So, it's in just in sum, Your Honors, we think that the union has not shown that the arbitrator exceeded his authority. Clearly, on the part that was affirmed by the district court, all the union is doing is asking you to second-guess the arbitrator's interpretation of the collective bargaining agreement. With regard to the appeal of the part of the award vacated, we believe that the arbitrator was using his broad authority to remedy the wrong, and that it was a continuing violation, and that it wouldn't make it would be costly, duplicative, and a waste of the party's resources, and would subvert the policy behind arbitration, which is to provide a quick, economical, and final resolution to the
quick
parties in their disputes.
Quick? How long does it take?
Quick is a relative term.
Yeah, I guess.
But it's supposed to be more speedy than going into court.
Yeah, 16 years or something?
In this case?
Yeah.
Well, I would submit that that policy has been subverted in this case. Thank you, Your Honors.
Of course, you were one of the subverters.
No.
You didn't accept the arbitrator's decision. You leapt into court to litigate about it.
Well, we leapt into court when we were advised by the union that they wouldn't pay, that they wouldn't comply with the arbitrator's award. And we first moved to enforce. Thank you, Your Honors.
All right. Thank you very much. Anything further, Mr. Ketterman?
Briefly, Your Honor. Judge, the quote, just to be clear, that you quoted from the arbitration award on page 10, that was the when you quoted the company established this case by proving that the union had agreements most likely unwritten. That was in the arbitrator's summary of the party's contentions.
That isn't an accurate quote. It was succinct. That's why I underlined it.
Exactly.
You may have a better quote.
I just wanted to, but that quote came from the
Where's
arbitration
the
award summarizing the party's contentions. It was not.
Where is your quote that you're saying?
Page 10 of the arbitration award.
Oh, no, that's where I am. Where are you that you say the proper language that says in your favor?
Your quote was fine. I just wanted to point out that that came in the context of the arbitrator summarizing the party's contention.
And I'm asking, where is the quote that says that he had to have two contracts?
We would use 21.1, the most favored nations provision, which
it's
says
not in the order,
agreed
though.
To. Well, 21.1 is found on page.
Where he's quoting it, you mean?
Well, he quotes the arbitration award. Page 12 onto page 13. I would briefly just like to, again, return to the concept of the arbitrator improperly exercising authority after October 1st, 2005. There's no doubt that the deferential standard of review allows an arbitrator properly selected by the parties to interpret, even misinterpret, the contract. But as the district court notes, there is no case which allows an arbitrator to exercise authority under a subsequent agreement when that subsequent agreement bars that arbitrator. And again, it bears repeating. The union time and time again objected to the exercise of that authority after October 1st, 2005. This is not a waiver case. And it's also worth repeating, what is that issue? After October 1st, 2005, if you assume Prate's argument is correct, and that the union failed to enforce the agreement after 2005. The agreement it was failing to enforce was the 2005 agreement. And any allegation that there was a violation of that agreement had to be determined by the standing panel of arbitrators.
You think that applies equally to the equitable decision of the arbitrator as opposed to the award of damages?
It applies to both after October 1st, 2005. And again, with the in regards to the equitable, that violates Section 18.2 of the agreement, which prohibits the employer from changing the wage rate. I see my time has expired.
That's a whole different question.
Mm-hmm. Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you very much. The case is taken under advisement.